Hello, college football fans. Welcome to episode 171 of College Football Throwdown. I'm your co-host, Alex Schmitz, and today I'm joined, as always, by my dad, Peter Schmitz.
Hello, college football fans and Husker fans.
Hello, hello. And we are here for our spring update. It's been a while since our last podcast, right after the national championship game. We are a father-son duo here to talk about college football by college football fans for college football fans. And for this podcast, we'll be focusing exclusively on some national topics, kind of closing the circle on the coaching carousel that was still spinning wildly last time we did a podcast, as well as some of the big updates that have happened in the national world of college football since January.
That's right. There's lots to do, or I should say lots that has been going on.
Yes, and we'll be doing another podcast on the Husker-specific news because there's a lot of shakeups there as well.
Yes.
But before we dive into all that, we've got to stick with our tradition and open up a cold beverage. I've got my last Japanese Sapporo beer here.
Uh-huh. And I am drinking the newest beer being offered by Yuengling. It's the last one of this particular variety that I have because I'm now back in Michigan and they don't sell Yuengling here. But it's called Flight, just the word flight. And it's described, it's a, you know, less than 100 calorie next generation light beer, it's called. And it's the Yuengling Flight.
Interesting. All right. Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers. I tell you, down in Florida, they were doing a ton of marketing on this product. So going to be interesting to see how it is received in the marketplace, because they sure are putting a lot of effort into it.
Oh yeah, but you like it, you've already had it.
Yeah, it's nice. I think it's a little lighter than their Yuengling light, like it's lower calorie and tastes maybe a little lighter. It's a good entry. It's very much going to be like a Miller light. I would say it's very similar to those kinds of flavors.
All right. There's dad's beer review for you all out there.
There you go.
So as I mentioned, our last podcast was right after the national championship game, and we were still in the throes of what was going on with Alabama after the retirement of Nick Saban. And there were lots of names being thrown around. You know, it was a crazy week, but you can tell that Saban had talked to the administration ahead of time and they were already doing some work and had the people they wanted in mind. Because just a few days after we did that podcast, it was announced that Kalen DeBoer, who was Washington's coach and coached them to a trip to the national championship game, was leaving to go to Alabama, which did seem like it caused some, kind of hurt feelings among the Husky fans out there. But you can't blame him for taking, such a step up of a job, right?
Well, that's correct. I mean, that's the opportunity of a lifetime for him. And he wasn't really tied to the West necessarily, as far as his history, most of it had been in the heartland, frankly. So, he's kind of just moving up the football ladder a little bit. Right. I would say that the bigger surprise is you just were in the Final Four at the University of Washington. They just joined the Big Ten. So they're going to be in the big money soon enough. And you don't ever want to be the guy that follows a legend. Right. You want to be the guy that the guy who follows the legend. Right. That's the sweet spot you're hoping to hit. So it'll be interesting to see how much patience Alabama has with him, because he's not an Alabama guy. And but from what I know of DeBoer, he is highly, highly regarded and is, I think, got as good a chance of anybody of being successful. Great recruiter. And a really, really good tactician, actual X's and O's coach.
Right. Now, if I recall right from that last podcast, you kind of thought that the best choice, even if he might not be the most popular, was Lane Kiffin, since he does have those Alabama ties and was working with Saban for quite some time. What do you think of that now in retrospect?
You know, I think that the athletic director at Alabama knew what he wanted, you know, knew the type of coach that he wanted. And I think that the whole, you know, connection to Alabama, connection to Nick Saban was not a priority for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's fair. And yeah, I think it's a pretty good choice for them, you know, at Alabama. I do feel sorry for mm-hmm. Washington. We'll get into that more in our Nebraska-specific podcast, but they've lost a lot after having a great season.
Right, right. If you look at DeBoer, I mean, he was going to lose a bunch of his best players, right? They were all graduating. So that was a peak year for that Washington program, whether he stayed or left. And so him taking the opportunity to move on to a greener pastures and a better opportunity, it just was a natural fit.
Yeah. And so they also got their replacement pretty quick at Washington, which is Jed Fish from Arizona, who had a good season. I want to say they went like 11-3 or something close to that. And Arizona replaced him with Brent Brennan, who was the San Jose State head coach. So that kind of completed that cycle of the coaching carousel over there.
Right.
Yeah. What do you think about the Jed Fish hire for Washington?
You know, again, I from what, well, because that also is going to play into Nebraska here again shortly when we talk about things later. You know, I actually thought it was a good hire at that time. I thought it was a very good hire. I think he's an up and coming coach. You know, if you looked at, you know, who was available, I think he was a guy that would have I think will do well there, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and he clearly has the skill of taking guys that aren't the top recruits, you know, more 2 stars and 3 stars, and getting them to play at a high level, which is something that he'll need to do at Washington as well, though probably to a lesser extent than he had to at Arizona.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, he was, again, much like DeBoer, kind of moving to a better neighborhood, right? He's leaving an Arizona team that, you know, is going to be moving on to the Big 12 and instead is going to be heading up a program that's going into the much larger money Big 10.
Yeah.
So from that standpoint, I think as a coach, that's where you'd like to be if you could make it happen.
Very true. And similarly, on the last podcast, we talked a bit about if Jim Harbaugh was going to leave, because, you know, there's always discussions in every Michigan offseason if he was going to leave for the NFL. And after A, finally doing what he wanted to do and winning a national championship, and B, running it into all the issues he did with the NCAA the past season, we both thought that it was more likely than not that he would leave. And once again, that turned out to be true. Pretty shortly after the fact, he announced that he'd be leaving for the LA Chargers. And unsurprisingly, Michigan promoted from within their offensive coordinator, Sherrone Moore, who had been in some of the other head coaching, you know, conversations that have been going around that time. You know, he was well respected. He had been the interim head coach during the games where Harbaugh was suspended from being out on the field and things like that. So he kind of already, you know, got his training wheels in, I guess you could say, as a head coach. But I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that decision by Harbaugh and the administration? And what have you heard about that from your friend, Brian, our big Michigan fan?
Brian is taking a wait and see on the Sherrone Moore hire and whether or not that will work long term. He obviously respects what he did. And the thing that you have to, you know, appreciate about Moore is, you know, he's a guy that has kind of paid his dues, right? Like he has been successful at a lot of the previous places he's been at. So it's kind of appropriate that he gets this next opportunity. He kind of ended up being in the right place at the right time. But again, much like I said about DeBoer, Coach Harbaugh's decision to leave was made easier by the fact that they were clearly at a peak on the roster, right? They had not only a lot of talent, but they had a lot of mature talent on that team that won the national championship. They still are going to have a lot of talent, but it's not going to be nearly as mature. And so it's going to be interesting to see how quickly, you know, Moore can stabilize what's going on there in Michigan, and you know, what he can do in terms of navigating whatever the ultimate total of suspensions and penalties that they receive from the NCAA regarding the multiple investigations that are going on there with the NCAA.
Right. Well, that was going to be my other topic, which is that it does kind of look like, you know, Harbaugh's kind of walking away from a fire, you know, that he left behind, because we all know about the sign stealing stuff that really blew up last year. But just this week, it was announced that the NCAA was putting down violations and penalties to Michigan for various recruiting violations that they made, like during the COVID periods, you know, breaking some of the rules there and things of that nature. So that's supposed to be a 3-year probation that includes, reduced recruiting numbers and things of that nature.
Right. Well, and the thing is that usually, historically, again, the NCAA has no teeth, so who knows what's going to happen. But if the infractions committee does in fact conclude that, you know, Michigan is guilty of some of these other accusations that they're still investigating, typically, if you are found guilty of multiple infraction issues, you know, in a sequence, you know what I mean? Like second, third time offense type of deal. Not of the exact same thing, but I'm saying, if you're already under probation and then you get another issue, then usually that elevates the punishment of that second issue, much like in a court of law, that often is the case, right? So I'll be curious to see if the NCAA has the guts to do that to the reigning national champions.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I know you've said in the past that it kind of seemed like they were, you know, maybe picking on Harbaugh in particular, maybe because of some of his, you know, kind of personality quirks, like the whole thing about the sandwich, you know, that he bought for a player and things of that nature, which I think is true to a certain extent. But, you know, if there's smoke, there's fire, right? And we know that there was some shady stuff going on, and that Harbaugh's a little bit like Saban, right? In that, you know, he was willing to bend the rules to try to get a competitive advantage.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, you know, those that defend him, like our friends here in Michigan, you know, they would say that, you know, he was doing exactly like Saban. He was bending the rules. He was figuring out just exactly where that line was, and then just pushing it just a little farther where there might be some gray area. And you know, and that goes back to him doing the satellite camps and him, you know, doing some of the crazy stuff he did in recruiting, him taking the entire team on these, you know, trips to Europe every year and stuff, things of that nature, right? Where the official NCAA rule was you can only do that once every 4 years, and he was doing it every year. And the reason the NCAA had to put that in place was to keep people from basically trying to buy recruits' affection by, you know, setting up an arrangement where they get a, you know, do all this really cool stuff, right? The wealthy schools could start taking their teams everywhere. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the whole point of the rule, and he ignores it. So it's just that tendency to do that. You're always kind of raking the edge of the NCAA's, you know, rule book and pissing them off. And so, of course, they're going to be a little more sensitive to any occasions when you go too far. And so, you know, he was guilty of putting that target on his own back.
Yeah, very true. So, yeah, that ends one of the, you know, more exciting coaching carousel years we've had in a while. You know, we've had quite a few big ones recently, actually. You know, a lot of big time coaches leaving or getting fired and things of that nature. Yep. Now, I thought it'd be cool to do a quick sort of tabulation on some of the rules changes that happened in last year's season of college football. The most significant of one, of course, being the rolling clock, right? The fact that the clock doesn't stop after you get a first down, you know, between getting a first down and the ball being set back on the field, more like the NFL rules.
Then that rule, that was true except in the last 2 minutes, or was that all the time?
I can't even remember that rule. It's already fading. It's been so long since he's watched football, folks. No, you're correct. In the last 2 minutes, it went back to the old rules.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes. So I found this helpful article on a website called blessyourchart.com, which is seems to be more of like a scientific website, you know, than football or sports, you know. And this guy, you know, put in all the data and tabulated and had graphs and bars, you know, and statistical analysis for 792 FBS games from last season. So I'd say, you know, his numbers are pretty accurate.
Yeah, that gives you a 1 year snapshot.
Right. You know, and you can compare it directly to like 2022, right? In terms of like, okay, this year we did it. We didn't have this rule this year. We did have the rule. What was the change? So in terms of shortening the game, both in terms of actual time and number of plays, it really had very little effect, was the final result. It cut down the average length of a game by 4 minutes. And in terms of plays, there were basically two less plays per game per team. So 4 less plays overall in a game. That was how it averaged out. Our understanding from what the NCAA said about the rule change at the beginning was that the main purpose wasn't to shorten the games. It was to reduce injuries, you know, by reducing the number of plays. And I was not able to find any good numbers of like total number of injuries in 2023 and like seeing if it was, you know, less than 2022 or anything like that. So I honestly don't know if it had any real impact there. But if you're only taking out 4 plays, you know, over the course of a whole game, I can't believe it would have that drastic of an effect on injuries either.
I would agree. And I don't like it because I think it takes away a considerable amount of, you know, of strategy, you know, that was built into the game, especially in the latter stages of each half. And just the overall for the whole length of the game, the ability for one team to take advantage of, you know, that clock stopping or to facilitate it starting again so as to run it faster than the other team would want it to be running. So I just feel like it took some strategy out of the game that I personally liked and felt was more beneficial to running teams, which I tend to be more fond of. I never liked the rule. You may recall that from our podcast when it came out. I'm actually pleasantly surprised to hear that it only took 4 plays away, but I still don't like the rule. And if that is the net result, then they ought to go back
right
the old way, as far as I'm concerned.
I was also, when the rule was initially announced, my feeling was, I don't like the sounds of that, but let's see how it is, because the NCAA Rules Committee did say like that they're willing to reevaluate this change and see if it's working, you know, or how it plays out in practice.
Right.
And maybe 1 year is too small of a sample size, you know, so they have not changed it yet. But I would say if this is the consistent result, what this guy found, then I would say both sides of the argument are probably overblown, and that it's not like changing the game so much that it's, you know, ruining the sport, right? We still had plenty of close games, you know, last minute comebacks, things of that nature last year. And if it's only taking out 4 plays on average, right, that's not a lot. But at the same time, it's also not helping a lot. It's not shortening the games. It's probably not, you know, cutting down on injuries in any significant amount. So if it's, you know, kind of a wash either way, then why not just go back to what's been working for 100 years?
Right, exactly. I doubt that they'll ever review it. you know what I mean? They said that, well, we can change it back kind of thing, or left open the possibility that they would review it. Because I think the number of issues that are that those committees are confronted with every year because of various agendas within and external to the sport, are going to continue to pound them, and this will just fall into oblivion, and people will view it, like you just said, in the overall, it was a minor effect, and it does put the game more in line with how the NFL operates. And so from that standpoint, you're actually bringing those two games closer together, which many would argue is a better thing for the sport.
Right. Well, speaking of that, literally just today, as we're recording this on April 19th, the NCAA Playing Rules Oversight Panel announced that they had voted and approved several rules changes that will directly affect the games, some of which we kind of saw coming from last year. We knew they were in consideration. It includes helmet communication, so having a microphone, you know, in your helmet to communicate with a coach like you have in the NFL. They approved one player on each team being able to do that, you know, on both sides of the ball. They also approved having digital tablets on the sidelines for coaches and players, and also wanted to introduce the 2-minute warning, once again, like the NFL. Which in terms of the 2-minute warning, I suppose that in some ways that sort of offsets a little bit, right? The fact that the clock runs faster because you get a guaranteed, you know, timeout at the 2-minute mark. And at that point from then on,
yep,
you know, the clock doesn't run automatically after first downs. So I feel like, you know, I guess it's kind of a one way or the other, right? If you're going to keep the rolling clock, then you might as well have the 2-minute warning as well, or go back to the old college football rules, you know?
Right. So, well, and that's why I think they'll never go back to the old ones. This new 2-minute rule concept, again, aligns us with more closely with the NFL rules, right? And frankly, what I said back a year ago when this, that other rule about running clock was introduced, this is really about them being able to run more commercials, and that each game is going to be more commercials and less game. That's ultimately what's happening here. Because now if they measure, after this gets implemented, if they measure the length of a game, I'll bet you that 2 minutes that was saved by the running clock concept will more than be consumed by a 2-minute warning, because that's now an automatic television break that will probably be 2 minutes or 3 minutes long.
Well, actually, I looked at like the comments, some of the specifics when this rule change was announced, and it said that it is specifically not a TV break. It's supposed to stay on the field, but it said, I didn't quite understand it, but they said it was supposed to be like a slot where they could put a TV timeout to try to avoid the scenario where you have a touchdown, go to commercials, then you come back, you see the kickoff, and you go to another commercial break, right? Everyone hates that. So I guess this slot is supposed to be, you know, a slot that's in there so that you can avoid one of those maybe and put that commercial in this place instead. That's my general understanding of it, but I'm not sure if that's correct. Yeah.
Well, we'll see how ironclad that is, because ultimately, if the TV partners say, hey, we really want that, and it's already a break in the action, then I guarantee you the media partners will win out.
Yeah, you may be right there. But in terms of the other implementations, right, tablets on the sidelines and the helmet communication, that both those things were already kind of given a beta test in the bowl games last season.
Right.
It seems whatever they learned from that was a success. Now, obviously, this whole conversation got amplified by the sign stealing controversy by Michigan from last year. However, it seems that because they're only allowing one player to have it, which will likely be the quarterback or, you know, the lead defensive player, then most likely the teams that want to run a hurry up offense will still have the signs, because they still need to be able to communicate like to their wide receivers, hey, this is what your route's going to be. You know, we're not huddling, just look at the sign. So it'll probably reduce the signs overall, but not eliminate them.
That's true. You are correct. And it's really hard, you know, with the signs from the sidelines, you know, they would make efforts to block the view of the coach who was giving the signs, or they'd have three people doing the signs and one of them was the real sign and the other two were fake, you know, all that kind of stuff. Right. I hope that what this does is it motivates people to huddle up more, because now that you've got a guy, he can go into the huddle, you know, put his hands over the ear holes so he can hear it nice and clear. And then he can give everybody, you know, in the huddle, the play, right? The old fashioned way. And, so I would really love it if that's maybe one of the results of this, is that it motivates people to eliminate all of their communication, at least on offense, by huddling up. Now, defensively, I think you might still have to have some, because a lot of times, you know, there's multiple calls, right? There's at every level of the defense. The defensive line has one call, the linebackers has another, and the DBs have a third, right? And so, and each of those groups is looking to their position coach to get a signal, right? And it's all coordinated at some level as well. I don't know how that will effectively be done unless, again, they do more huddling, which I wouldn't mind seeing.
Right. And you don't really hear about the defensive sign stealing so much, right? Because it's a much greater advantage to know what the offense is going to do, you know.
Correct.
Whereas with the defense, you can read certain things just from their formations and stuff.
Right. And if you stole a defense's signs and then you changed your offensive alignment, the defense can change their defensive alignment. So it's not nearly as useful. So there's not as much fear of stealing them, right, as there would be on the offensive side. So the biggest impact that this will have is on offense.
Right. Yep. So, you know, overall, I think these are good changes. You know, like I mentioned, if we're sticking with the first down rolling clock thing, then having a 2-minute warning makes sense. You know, we hope that it doesn't lengthen TV commercials, but we'll see. And helmet communication, the tablets both make sense for modern technology. You know, like you said, it kind of helps Nebraska because we already are huddling, you know. So we will benefit from having that helmet communication for our quarterback. But yeah, we'll see how it plays out this year.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm actually happy with this particular change and I'm hopeful that it ends up leading to, more of a traditional football experience. And it eliminates the whole sign stealing thing for the most part. And I love that. But I still hope that that doesn't mean the NCAA just turns a blind eye to what Michigan was doing. Because I as you know, even though I'm not anti-Michigan per se, I would like to see them punished for what I believe was a blatant and arrogant abuse of that process, right?
Yes.
And then it was the arrogance that led to them being caught, frankly.
Right. Having, you know, I mean, that guy, you know, Connor, whatever his name was memed to all hell and back last year, right? Because he's just this dude, you know, going on both sides of the field, wearing these glasses and all this sort of stuff.
Exactly. Just stupid.
Yeah. And then our last national topic is another piece of news that's come down this week that's somewhat interesting with Colorado and Deion Sanders. With the spring transfer portal opening up this week, he's already had 14 players leave in this 1 week alone, bringing up the total since the end of their last season to 26 players who have left.
Keep in mind that just means people that have gone into the portal. They haven't left yet,
right?
Because not all of them have a landing spot, right? They're just getting into the portal. So some of them, maybe many of them, might find their way back, right? They might end up coming back out of the portal and come back to Colorado if it's mutually agreed by both the Colorado staff and the player.
Right. Though I saw, you know, some headline or something with Deion saying, like, what are we losing? You know, kind of like downplaying the players that are leaving. So, you know, I'm not sure Deion is the type to say forgive and forget, you know, oh, come back in, you know, after you've kind of turned your back on him. But, you know, from my perspective, it's like, well, you reap what you sow, right? The fact that Deion famously, when he got in, you know, let a bunch of the current players go and brought in a whole ton of transfers, you know, to try to beef up his team quickly. And then they ended up having a great start to their year, but a very disappointing ending, which led to some of the exodus we saw earlier on, like back in January. And now it seems like there's further stuff. I have not been following, you know, the Colorado football saga, so I don't know the specifics on like why all this is happening, but it did include a few starter players as well, like significant contributors.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know exactly, you know, the definition of starters a little vague, but yeah, at least five guys, I'm told, of that group are players that had that contributed significantly to the team last year. And some of them are even 4- and 5-star players. So they were highly regarded going into the Colorado program. And one of them is a guy that just transferred in. So, so the AD from Colorado has been quoted already, maybe even tweeted on his own social media and being very critical of the portal. I think that's just pot calling the kettle black, complaining about the fact that, you know, these players, I mean, he didn't even play a down for Colorado, right? He came into the portal at the end of the semester in December, stayed for spring practice, didn't see or experience what he wanted, and is now leaving, right? So, and is going to end up landing somewhere else and be immediately eligible. So it allows the players then to basically, you know, market their wares and dip their toe in the water and then go somewhere else. And if you're talented enough, some other programs are going to take a shot. They're going to take a chance on you, right? And in the meantime, how much money did they get in NIL from the NIL collective at Colorado, right? Right. I don't know the answers to those questions, but I suspect the answer is some money.
From what I recall, when I was looking into the NIL stuff a little more thoroughly, it was like, you know, you'd get a big number, say, you know, $1 million or whatever, but it's like paid out, you know, by semester over the course of 4 years. Right. So, you know, that person might have gotten a bit of money, but not anything like too crazy, unless you're like a major player, right? And you're a quarterback and maybe there's like a signing bonus, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, but regardless, the fact is that the NIL collective resources for that university gave him money, even if it was just for this one semester, right? He got money for the last 4 or 5 months from them, and they're never going to see this guy during an actual game, right? Like that's just lost money. So if you're that school and that NIL collective, you're kind of pissed about the fact that you just wasted, you know, giving this guy $4,000-$5,000, whatever, $10,000 a month for 4 months. You know, yeah, that's not huge money, but that's a lot more than any, you know, Division I athlete ever got before. Right. And he's getting it for free, and then he's moving on to another school. I mean, it's just crazy.
Right. Well, and you would hope that would be kind of a self-regulating mechanism on these collectives, right? Like, as they see the trends over time, and they're like, you know, guys, we're giving tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to, 18-year-olds.
Right.
And, you know, who aren't coming here because they, you know, necessarily love Colorado. They're coming because we gave them this money. Maybe this isn't the best, you know, return on investment, as you might say.
Exactly. Well, and can they put some stipulations on it, or would they be willing to have that kind of discipline? But again, if any other collective doesn't, you know, the competitive reality is then that's a competitive advantage. If you're willing to take that risk, knowing that sometimes you're going to get burnt, then you're never going to be outbid, so to speak, by another school. If you were to say, hey, we're going to be fiscally conservative here, and we're not, it's not that we're not going to give players NIL money, but we're only going to give it to them after they've actually played in a game for our team. Meaning that if someone transfers at the beginning of second semester, they don't get any NIL money until the following fall, right? Until they actually have played in a game.
Right.
But to do that, that would mean that you run the risk of other teams not having that policy and going ahead and giving them the money immediately. And all it takes is a couple of schools to do that, and that becomes the new standard, or you fall behind in recruiting in the portal era.
Very true. Very true.
I'm going to mention one more thing, because we started this podcast with a conversation, and since we're on the NIL portal subject, we're going to talk about a quarterback who left Nebraska, looked like they were all set, go to Boise State, then got another person came into the portal that the Boise State folks, or coaches, had higher on their list of interest, so they ended up moving in a different direction. So the kid ended up going to San Jose State, was going to be close to his brother, who plays for the San Francisco 49ers. Brock, was the quarterback at San Francisco. I'm talking about Chuba. So he ended up committing and transferring academically everything to San Jose State, which is right outside of San Francisco. And then his coach gets the opportunity to go to the Arizona or Arizona State, whichever that was.
Arizona.
Yeah. Okay. Where Fish left. And so now he finds himself stuck at San Jose State. They didn't hire a new coach who is from one of the academies and runs option football. So he's now stuck as a quarterback, right? Or you would think he would be stuck as a quarterback, having transferred, to a school that now is no longer a good fit for him. And then he ends up transferring again. See, right. And that's the musical chairs that this opens up, right? And that's just one example of somebody that I'm familiar with, because they were previously a Nebraska player. But I guarantee you there are some other examples of that. And I think that's going to become more and more common, not less common, as we move forward.
Yep. I mean, that's why it was good that you specified earlier, right, about Colorado, that those players were in the portal, but they had not officially left yet, right? Because, right. You're presuming that you'll be able to get, the spot you're looking for, a transfer to a similarly positioned school, or one of, what do you want to say, acceptable value to you, acceptable reputation.
Right.
But a lot of these kids might find that the reality is that school just doesn't exist. They don't have an opening.
Right. So, and here's the other thing. I mean, the statistics are starting to be built, and I think the ones that I've seen, and again, I'm going to throw some numbers out there that are things that I think are in the ballpark of the stats that I saw. I don't have it in front of me. The bottom line though is that around 55 to 60% of the players who go into the portal actually end up at another institution. Okay. 60%. Now that doesn't mean that they necessarily stay at the level or get to a school that's better or their preferred choice over where they were. It just means that at some point they ultimately make a decision to go somewhere else and continue their athletic endeavors. Right. Then there is another percentage, and it's less than 10%, that actually return from the portal and go back to the school that they originally were in. And then the other, 30%, right, are people that go into the portal and either never connect with another school, or they have to go down to a lower division to get the opportunity to play their sport again.
Right. Okay.
And in many cases are losing their scholarship money, or losing the magnitude of their scholarship money, and their NIL opportunity is greatly diminished if they're going down a level. Right. So when those kinds of statistics have 3 or 4 years of data, and people begin to realize that, hey, you go into the portal, there's a 40% chance that you're going to end up worse off than you are now.
Right.
And I hope that will then become an educational tool, where some of these young people will be given some clear and concrete advice about their decisions.
Right. And just one clarifying question. So if I'm a player at Nebraska and I have a scholarship, but I then choose to go into the portal and I end up kind of getting stuck there, like you say, I'm the 30%. As soon as I choose to go in the portal, do I lose my scholarship? You know, I'm attending the university still, but I'm having to pay for it out of my own pocket now.
I believe if you're already, whatever semester you're in, you know, you've the scholarship is already paid for your semester. Right. So like, that's why a lot of these guys wait and don't get into the portal. You know, Nebraska didn't start until like January 22nd. They didn't come back from Christmas until like the third week of January, right? There was an extended winter break. So some of the guys would wait until they got back into school. You get into school for 3 days, then you go into the portal. You know what I mean? So there's mm-hmm. some gamesmanship you have to play because of the window of the portal and the window of when the school begins the second semester. But ideally, you want to be into that semester and then go into the portal. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Then that semester is paid for and you're good to go. Now, I would say that as soon as you go into the portal, I think it's completely legitimate for that school to terminate any NIL money that was coming your way, right? So that happens immediately, I suspect. But the actual scholarship, then you would be on scholarship until the end of that semester. So then you have the remainder of the semester to effectively go out and hunt for a new home.
Okay. Well, there you go. There's some education for all the listeners out there.
That's right.
I didn't know the specifics there myself. So we'll talk more about some national topics as we go further into the off season. We'll be talking about the Huskers next, and we'll surely be coming back with a podcast about the spring game and the results. We'll see where we go from there.
That sounds great.
All right. So if you all out there enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can email us at huskerpete13@gmail.com. You can also reach out to us on Spotify if you search for College Football Throwdown. We're also on Apple Podcasts if you prefer to listen to us there. You can leave us a rating or a review. We always love listening to the fans' feedback. So thank you all out there for listening, and thank you, Dad, for joining me for this episode. And until next time, go Big Red.
Go Big Red.